Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. In the first part of the show, we speak to author and professor Robert Jensen about his newest book, All My Bones Shake, and the importance of naming the system. In the second part of the show, we speak to Dr. Martha Eckelsberg about feminism and her new book, Resisting Citizenship. Stay tuned.
Eterno en la vida, porque todito es prestado. Nada es eterno en la vida, porque todito es prestado. No más lo pendejo es firme y nace sin ser sembrado. No más lo pendejo es firme y nace sin ser sembrado. Y nace sin ser sembrado, porque nadie lo sembró. Y nace sin ser sembrado, porque nadie lo sembró. Todo mal tiene remedio, no más lo pendejo no. Todo mal tiene remedio, no más lo pendejo no.
Drum and bass now.
De los pendejos, que los vivos cuidarán de ti. Cuídate de los pendejos, que los vivos cuidarán de ti. Hay pendejos que hacen guerras y otros que eligen por ti. Date cuenta, compañera, que no decidan por ti. Dile, wow, wow, wow. Hay que pensar, hay que reflexionar, que una actitud arrogante nos puede condenar. Ni los libros ni la escuela nos quitan lo pendejo. Hay que mirarse para poder llegar a viejo. Hay que pensar, hay que reflexionar, que una actitud negativa nos puede traicionar. Ni los libros ni la escuela nos quitan lo pendejo. Hay que mirarse para poder llegar a viejo.
Si porque me ves pendejo tratas de volverme loco, si porque me ves bien pendejo tratas de volverme loco, te lo digo compañera, me estoy yendo poco a poco, te lo digo y lo repito, hasta la arpa ya no toco.
That was the incredible lyrics of Rastrillos, a fabulous group from Mexico who will be touring Canada this summer. The song is titled Pendejo. Pendejo means, it's sort of an endearing way to tell your friend, you screw up, you're stupid. But not in the way of realizing that ignorance, it's prevalent even among academics sometimes. We choose what things we want to believe in, sort of we go that way. And what it's saying is that neither education nor nurturing can remove that unless we're willing to remove the bandages from our eyes and actually see and face our responsibilities. Someone who has made his life a quest for not only live a reflective life, but to show us the path to the prophetic voice is Dr. Robert Jensen. He is my guest this morning. His latest book, All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, is an amazing book. Dr. Jensen is a professor at the University of Austin, Texas. He teaches media, ethics, and politics. And he's written many books, including Getting Off, The Heart of Whiteness, Citizens of the Empire, and Right in Descent. It is a real privilege to have him on our show. Welcome to our show, Dr. Jensen.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
Now, for many people, looking at society critically, it's something that we don't do presently. We don't do in a real conscious way. I think we've become so overwhelmed by all the different things that we want to pursue that I don't know that we're always aware of our surroundings. In your book, you touch on theology, political theology, and you describe how in so many ways we've been concerned about dying, we've been concerned about how did we get created, but very few people are really considering the question, how do we live, and why is the most important question. So what do you mean by political theology?
Well, of course, any theology is in some sense political, because theology at its best helps us understand what it means to be a human being. And what it means to be a human being, of course, is the question at the core of any politics. What are our obligations to ourselves? What is our obligation to others? What is our obligation to the larger non-human world? All of that depends on what you believe a human being to be. And, of course, there are some differences in theologies around that. So any theology is political. What I'm trying to do in that book is craft a what I would call a progressive theology, that is, one that does not depend on supernatural claims about a God that's up in the sky directing our lives, for instance. So it tries to look at theology as a set of stories and traditions that have been used by people to try and understand a complex world, and to marry that theology to what I believe is a very necessary radical politics. And by radical, I just mean a politics that looks at basic systems. And as you pointed out in your introduction, looking at the basic systems in which we live is not easy for people, because it's those systems from which we tend to get our identity, our understanding of ourselves. You know, I think a lot of us are asking at this particular moment in history is very difficult, which is to, you know, put everything up to question. Let me give you a couple of examples. In this country, it's assumed that politically we should be organized around the idea of a nation state, and that our primary identity in this country is as U.S. citizens, or as Americans, as we like to say. Another assumption is that the only sensible way you can organize an economy is in corporate capitalism, and that's where a lot of people get their identity as well. I'm suggesting both of those have to be challenged. that in fact we should not think of ourselves primarily as U.S. citizens, as Americans, and in fact that we should not assume that a capitalist economy is the sane and sensible way to organize an economy. Well, when you talk at that level, of course, it's not only contentious, that is, people not only disagree, but people often feel not only challenged, I think, but attacked when you bring those kind of questions to bear.
In your book, you point out how we've known for some time that we are on a collision course in terms of our consumption patterns and the way our world's finite resources are coming to an end. And you really force us to look at that reality and say, you know, this has been known. In 1992, those 1,700 world-leading scientists came out and warned us about this happening. And yet we seem to be unwilling or unable to answer the call, what is our responsibility? And you address some of the blinders as fundamentalisms, you know, the fundamentalisms that prevent us from perhaps moving forward. Can you talk a little bit about what are these fundamentalisms that have become those fibers of our identity that are preventing us from moving forward and creating the changes we need in order to survive?
Before I talk about the fundamentalisms, let's go back to the point you made, that the current structure of our economy is simply not sustainable, this high-energy, high-consumption lifestyle that in the first world is so common. I do critique that, but of course I'm not the only person and not the most knowledgeable person critiquing that. I'd just like to let listeners know there's a great piece in Scientific American, a very mainstream kind of magazine that tries to talk about science for ordinary people. So for those of us who aren't professional scientists, and I'm certainly not one, the April edition of Scientific American has two really important articles. One is a review from top-notch scientists and a group of scientists about where we sit in terms of resource use, pollution, climate change, that sort of thing. And then a very important excerpt from a new book by Bill McKibben, in which he talks about breaking the growth habit, that we've lived for the last 250 years on the assumption of unlimited growth, and that is the fundamental assumption that we have to change. Now, that's a kind of fundamentalism in economic terms, this notion of growth. And that's what I'm getting at when I talk about fundamentalisms, not just religious fundamentalism, not even just national fundamentalism, the kind of hyper-patriotism that defines this country. Of course, in economic fundamentalism we have to reject. But also, what I call and others have called a technological fundamentalism, a belief that this high-energy, high-technology world can go on indefinitely, even though we know quite clearly that we are running out of the major energy supplies that would make it possible, and at the same time, even if we had adequate energy, we are degrading the ecosystem at a rate that makes sustainable life impossible. So, you know, these are very basic questions. They're hard questions. I think people, for the most part, don't want to think about them because they don't have easy answers. And in fact, we have to consider the possibility there might not be answers at all, if by answers we mean quick solutions, easy solutions that will allow us to continue to live at the level we do. Quite frankly, I don't think we're going to continue to live at this level indefinitely. And the sooner we deal with that, I think the better.
One of the issues that we have to come to terms is the way capitalism, industrial capitalism, under neoliberalism has created and exacerbated the conditions of penury and misery for the poor. And in your book, you talk about facing the reality that the relatively comforts that we've share and enjoy in, you know, the North, in the wealthy countries, has been as a direct result of the expropriation and, you know, and all the resources that have been taken from the third world countries. How do we begin to create a connected view of the world that lets us see that this neoliberalism model is really poisoning workers against workers? And how do we break from those biases of patriarchy and, you know, racism that had entrenched those models of powers of domination?
Well, I think the first way we break with them is by being honest about them, and you're laying that out very clearly. Now, when we do that, when we talk about the nature of the systems, there's one thing we can be sure of, is people will accuse us of being divisive. That just happened to me by coincidence. Yesterday, I was in Dallas, Texas, giving a talk on diversity, but expanding the concept of diversity well beyond race and ethnicity to talk about all of the things you've just mentioned. And a relatively traditional kind of conservative fellow said, well, you know, we're all for diversity, but you're just being divisive now. That means that when we actually talk about the reality of the world and how it's structured, which of course means talking about winners and losers, people who've benefited from it and people who've been suffering because of it, then we're going to be accused by those people who benefited by, we're going to be accused of being divisive. So I said to the gentleman, I said, listen, I'm sorry if you think I'm being divisive, but I don't know how to solve problems without accurately naming the systems out of which those problems arise. And the problems we're talking about arise out of, as you point out, white supremacy, patriarchy, and a predatory corporate capitalism. Now, we have to name those. And I think people often say, well, you know, we know what the problem is. Let's move to solutions. And I want to say, no, actually, we don't agree, all of us, on the nature of the problem. There are people who think the neoliberal paradigm in capitalism can bring prosperity to all the world. Well, I don't agree with that. The reason I don't agree is I think the evidence is quite clear that it doesn't do that. But we need to hash that out before we start talking about solutions, because solutions within the neoliberal capitalist paradigm, I would argue, and many others have argued, aren't solutions at all. They just continue to prop up a system that will always be fundamentally unjust. So there's a lot of work to do just getting clear about the nature of the problems before we even start talking about solutions. That's, I think, where we start.
It's so exciting to hear you speak about the fact that we need to not only look at it through the gender lens, the class lens, and also realizing the many issues that are ingrained, that are how racism has really played a role. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way this struggle also shapes who we become, how our identity is then transformed through that struggle. Because it's not all about, you know, feeling guilty. It's not about guilty at all, in my view. It's about taking responsibilities and acting on it.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think you've just said it perfectly. I'm a white, middle-class U.S. citizen, a man, living rather comfortably in economic terms. You know, I have virtually all of the privilege that's available to people in this culture. Am I supposed to feel guilty about that? Well, that's tricky. Obviously, I can't feel guilty about the big systems and the historical realities. I didn't have much to do with how those came to be. But I can be accountable, as you say. I can stop grasping at systems of power and privilege just because they appear to give me not only material comfort, but some stable sense of identity. I can stop grasping at white supremacy and patriarchy and capitalism and nationalism and say, listen, I don't want to be the person those systems construct. I want to be somebody else. I want to be somebody whose commitments are to universal values and to communities, not to these sort of abstract identities that promise something but deliver so little beyond the material. So the first thing for people who look like me and are in positions like me, as you point out, is to get over this notion that people are just trying to make us feel guilty. What we're trying to do is understand the world and change the world to make it better. And to do that, we have to tell the truth about how that world has advantaged some people and disadvantaged others. I happen to be one of the people who have been advantaged by it. And I don't know a way to deal with that without, as you're saying, telling the truth about it. So in doing that, however, I'm not just giving something up. I am giving up a false sense of my own superiority, but I'm gaining something much more important, which is a deeper sense of my own humanity. When I make a move into this kind of politics, I'm inevitably going to put myself in the company of other people with similar goals. I'm going to meet a wider range of people. I'm going to make, I think, deeper kinds of relationships. So when people say to me, well, you've sacrificed so much, I say there's no sacrifice in this at all. Maybe I've given up a certain amount of material comfort. Maybe I've shared resources with others, whatever. But what I've gained is a much deeper and richer sense of myself, a much more meaningful life. I've made a wider range of friendships and alliances, and all of those have made my life much better. You know, people, my life, I'm 51 years old, and I sort of spent half my life resisting this kind of critique and half my life coming to terms with it. And for all of the struggles I might have these days, and there are some, I wouldn't trade for that old life. I wouldn't want to go back to that time in my life when I was smug and self-confident about being a middle-class, educated white guy in the United States. I like my life now, and that's, I think, in the end, a very important point, because we all know that if we're going to act in a way that's consistent with our principles, we're going to act for justice, that that's the right thing to do. That's the ethical imperative. But we also know that all of us don't act on ethical imperatives all the time. And so I think we have to craft an argument, what I would call an argument from self-interest to people with privilege, saying, listen, it's not just the right thing to do. It's going to benefit you. And here are some tangible ways it will benefit you. And that's why I talk so much about my own life. It may seem kind of self-indulgent. But if people like me who have privilege don't talk about why we've committed to certain kinds of struggles, then others like us don't have an idea, don't have a model of where to go. And it's only through other people modeling that choice and talking honestly about it. We all have a role in telling our story, not just because our story matters to us, but because it has to matter to others, too.
That is so wonderfully said. When you present people with the choice to act, invariably the issue of agency comes into play. And for many people, we are not taught that we are capable of creating any transformative change. How do you inspire your students? How do you inspire yourself to continue in spite of setbacks?
When I am asked how I inspire students, I don't want to be falsely modest. I think I've had a positive effect on a lot of students. I think it's as much an act of modeling than it is of lecturing to people. There, you know, lecturing to people is a way to convey certain types of information, but it's not a terribly, you know, productive way when you're trying to get people to think about how they're going to change. And I think the only way to do that is to model that change. For instance, in the classroom, I think the most important thing I do is model a kind of critical thinking, not just lecture to people about how they should see the world. Go through that act of thinking aloud in front of students. I think that's incredibly important. And that's the way we do things. It's by setting an example, not because we think we're right about everything, but that by engaging in the world that way, we can learn. And at the same time as we're learning, putting ourselves out in public to learn, we can also have a positive effect on others.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. His latest book, All My Bones Shake. How can people access your book?
The easiest way to find information about my writing is just to Google my name, Robert Jensen, and the first page that will come up is my homepage from the University of Texas, and there you'll find not only information about the books, but a lot of articles that are online at no charge. So hope people can take a look.
Thank you again for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Sylvia. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Con sus charros cibernéticos y zarapes de neón. Era un gran pueblo magnético,
con María sincrónica,
traga fuegos supersónicos.
Era un gran tiempo de híbridos.
igual, aquí nunca va a acabar. Un rasta ranchero y un escatero jaranero y una yacera que canta blues y bolero. Voy a un mestizaje cultural de la misma campechana mental.
Estos mensajes del profeta del nopal.
That was the incredible lyrics of the group Rastrillos.
You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.